hosts of The Secret Ingredient.
You can catch us every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m.
We listen to music and we talk about the invisible elements of art, such as the co-creation of work across disciplines and community building.
We hope you'll join us in our ongoing quest for The Secret Ingredient in Art every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m.
Attention metal fans! The third annual Kitchener Metal Fest is coming on Saturday, May 30th at the Wax Nightclub in Kitchener. Join headliners Varga with Cabe, Calling Chaos, Vic Viper, Act of Sin, Them Thieves, and the sensational Robbie Hayne Band.
The festival starts at 5 p.m. and door prizes will be given out throughout the night, including a guitar, recording time, a one-hour massage, and a $250 tattoo gift card. Tickets are $10 in advance and $12 at the door, and are available by emailing KitchenerMetalFest@gmail.com. All proceeds will go to the Grand River Regional Cancer Center. There is also a GoFundMe site available for those who can't make the festival but would like to donate.
That's the third annual Kitchener Metal Fest, Saturday, May 30th at the Wax Nightclub, 125 King Street West in Kitchener. Unfortunately, this venue is not fully accessible.
For more information, go to Facebook.com/KitchenerMetalFest.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and of course before the break we heard from the Angelic Upstarts from their album Stage Bottles, and that song was called Solidarity. And of course I played that song to express my own solidarity with the Palestinian people on the 67th anniversary of Nakba Day. Now, just to go a little further in this with this, I really want to, for those of whom may have forgotten, I want to illustrate just what really mostly these few news reports. They're from the Breaking the Set, which is a program which I'm really sorry to say does not exist anymore. That was the program Abby Martin had on RT America for a good while. And it was, of course, like very very activist, very progressive show. And she did a lot of pretty good programs where she really talked about what really is going on in Palestine and what the Israeli apartheid state is really inflicting on the Palestinian people. Most recently, of course, with the attack on Gaza, which took place last year. So I'm going to play a couple of clips talking about just really the elements of this conflict and just how the state, the Israeli state, treats the Palestinians. You know, the different terms within the media that have been used to try to justify the imperialist onslaught against Palestine and all this sort of stuff. Like, I kind of unpack all this. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
This week, disturbing footage was released of Israeli Defense Forces gunning down two unarmed Palestinian teenagers when they were simply participating in a protest. Their names were Muhammad Abu Bahr and Nadim Nawara. And the outright murder of these two boys highlights the impunity with which the IDF operates and raises questions as to whether or not the soldiers responsible were ever held accountable for the crime. Well, to help tackle the issue of Israeli impunity and the daily struggles millions of Palestinians face daily, earlier I spoke to Miko Peled, son of a former IDF general and grandson of one of Israel's founding fathers. He's also the author of The General's Son. I began by asking Milo to describe his own, quote, Palestinian treatment recently at an airport in Tel Aviv.
There's a sticker that you get as soon as you go in, and the sticker has a barcode and a serial number. And the serial number that starts with a 6 is the one that raises the red flag. That's the mark.
The
yeah. And I've never gotten a number 6. Palestinians always talk about that number, you know, quite often. And so at every point between when you walk into the airport to the terminal until you're actually on the plane, you know, if you're normal, if you're an Israeli, you don't notice. You just go from one place to another until you show up. But when you've got that number 6, they scan the barcode, and as soon as the number 6 comes up, you know, then they hold the phone, you know, hold everything, call a supervisor, do a special inspection, do another round of questioning, another round of bag checks. They opened the laptop a few extra times. They insisted on doing a body search, which I refused, and I, you know, told them they had no right to. I mean, if they couldn't treat a Palestinian different than they do me, I mean, neither one of us has a criminal record or a terrorist record. Why should we take our pants off?
Yeah, that's insane.
So they had us go through a metal detector a few extra times and that sort of thing, and made us wait and wait and wait and wait and wait. It's just horrible. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. And it only happens if you're a Palestinian.
I wanted to ask you about Rachel Corrie's case. Her parents finally got that appeal. The Supreme Court heard the case today. Of course, we won't hear the ruling for a couple months. What do you think the outcome will be?
I don't think there's going to be any different outcome than what they've had so far. As over the years where we've seen the Israeli army, Israeli police shooting protesters, whether they're Palestinians or not, they're never held accountable. They're never taken to court. I mean, there's a shield that protects the soldiers and the police from any kind of legal action. And the Israeli courts and the Israeli judicial system has always supported the military, has always supported the army, and I don't think that's going to change.
I can't help but think, would we even know who Rachel Corrie was if she was Palestinian? I mean,
the only reason we know
her name.
Probably not. And also, I mean, we might have known their name, but it would have been forgotten after 24 hours. But I think that her parents deserve, you know, all the respect. You know, God bless them. They're wonderful people. They work so hard and they're demanding justice. And they're going against the stream and against, you know, the system there.
Two incredible people really fighting on the ground there in Jerusalem constantly. Miko, I wanted to bring this to the horrific executions of the two Palestinian teenagers, 15-year-old Muhammad Abu Tar, 17-year-old Nadim Nuwara. A horrific footage here of just getting brutally gunned down, merely protesting, just walking around with backpacks. Can you describe the details surrounding this case?
Well, it's similar to other cases where there are protests and the Israeli army shoots to kill. I mean, they shoot to kill. It happened in Abi Saleh with Mustafa Tamimi. It happened, you know, countless times. I remember Mustafa Tamimi because it happened on my birthday a couple of years ago. So it's a day I'll never forget. And they know they're not going to be held accountable. Sometimes it happens during what they call clashes, which are, you know, protests, legitimate protests. In this case, this was both Nakba Day, when Palestinians commemorate their catastrophe, and it was in front of Ofer Prison, which is where Palestinians are tortured, interrogated, and held. And we have a hunger strike that began with hundreds of strikers and now thousands. The entire body of Palestinian political prisoners are on hunger strike. So it was in light of all of that, and they were demanding justice, and the Israeli army shoots to kill. They have no fear.
And the IDF has said, even this morning, they were still saying that they didn't have live ammunition. They're opening an investigation. But Miko, you're talking about accountability. I cannot help but bring up this shocking statistic. According to Haaretz, the IDF has killed over 5,000 Palestinians since 2000, 1,500 of which have been children, yet only six soldiers have been convicted for these offenses over the last 14 years, according to the Military Police Criminal Investigations Department. And I'm telling you that in those six instances, some of them are just a slap on the wrist, 3 months probation, etc.
Yeah.
How is this lack of accountability even possible?
Well, it's possible in a state which is inherently a racist state, where Palestinian lives don't count for anything. This is the reality in Israel. It's a racist state. It's a racist regime. Palestinians are not counted. Their lives don't count. This is why they're treated the way they are at the airport. This is why they're treated the way they are when they're shot in, you know, whether they're children or adults, it makes no difference, doing mostly peaceful protests. And even if they're not peaceful, then we're talking about rocks versus guns and tanks. This is why Palestinian communities inside Israel, Israeli citizens, are neglected and over 50% are below the poverty line. It's an entire system. It's an entire racist system. And you did that wonderful piece about Israel being an apartheid state. You hit the nail right on the head. That's exactly what it is. And these are all the different symptoms of a racist apartheid regime.
Let's talk about what Muhammad and Nadim were protesting, which is this insane amount of prisoners kept indefinitely, charges, no trial. Yeah. What kind of offenses are we talking about here that could land a Palestinian in jail indefinitely?
Well, what they're protesting now and what they protested in the past in the hunger strikes is the what they call administrative detention, where Palestinians are held without charge. Now, we're talking about the military judicial system, where the bar is set very, very low. Now, these Palestinians, hundreds of them, are held indefinitely even though no charges have been brought against him. In other words, even the military judicial system, which with its very low bar, found nothing with which to charge these people, yet they are held in prison indefinitely, beaten, tortured, and so forth. So the protest is against that, you know, and it began with several hundreds of them, the actual administrative detainees, on hunger strike, and then after that, about a week or two later, the entire body, some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners, have started a hunger strike. This is a massive hunger strike.
Yeah, and Samer Essawi was, of course, one of the most famous hunger strikers. Yes. He was released, but now his family is being harassed. Yes. His sister is awaiting trial. She's on hunger strike now. Talk about that case.
Well, his family's being harassed. She's being harassed. She's very outspoken. She's an advocate for Palestinian rights, particularly prisoners' rights. Samer holds the record for the longest number of days, or the most number of days, being on hunger strike and surviving.
It's insane.
I remember I was in Belfast standing by Bobby Sands' grave when Samer was still in jail, and everybody was praying that his fate would not be the same as Bobby Sands. Yeah. And the other Irishman who died. And now she's held in prison, again, administrative detention. In other words, they can bring no charges against her, and they're holding her. And now the trial has been postponed some 9 or 10 months, and she's supposed to just accept it. Mm-hmm. And the hunger strike is a powerful tool. It's a painful tool. I mean, the pain and the suffering they go through, and their families go through. And the system doesn't care. In other words, the Israeli certainly doesn't care. The Israeli judicial system is not supporting them. And the world seems to not care either, which is even more shocking.
The world seems to just think if you're a Palestinian, then you are a terrorist or you're some sort of an enemy combatant. Really unfortunate generalization there, Miko. According to a report by the Massawa Advocacy Center for Arab Citizens in Israel, Arab families living in Israel 4 times likelier than their Jewish counterparts to live in poverty. I want you to talk about the factors that you think are contributing to this extreme disparity.
The Israeli Knesset has passed dozens of laws that particularly and specifically target them, whether it's buying land, whether it's, you know, development and so forth, job opportunities, you name it. Now, besides that, the whole environment of racism and discrimination that they live, in which they live, it isn't always an issue of law, sometimes just an issue of the reality. So their lands have been confiscated, so they have no room to grow. They have not a single dollar, or you'd be hard-pressed to find a single dollar ever invested in anything in these communities, nor permits given for them to build. They're restricted in terms of, you know, employment and education and so forth. The Israeli secret police is always, you know, breathing down their necks. Even crime is not solved. I mean, I was just there, you know, for a few days, and I went to a wedding 2 days before the wedding of a friend in a Palestinian town inside Israel. A man was shot to death in broad daylight. The police will not come to investigate. And this is one out of dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of cases, where the police will not come in and investigate any kind of crime. So this is the kind of neglect, and this is the kind of reality in which these people live.
Author of The General's Son, social activist, really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's been 21 days since Israel launched its bombing campaign and subsequent invasion of the Gaza Strip. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, over 1,065 Palestinians have been killed and over 6,200 have been wounded in what has become one of the bloodiest offenses ever launched in the region. The overwhelming majority of casualties are civilians. On the contrary, 3 Israeli civilians have died due to Hamas-launched rockets, and 48 IDF soldiers have lost their lives. Over the last 24 hours, Israel has bombed more than 70 sites, including Gaza's power plant, the only provider of electricity to the territory's 1.8 million citizens. Additionally, Israel has targeted and shelled dozens of medical facilities, refugee centers, and is wiping out entire families every day. Yet despite the extreme disproportionality of the massacre, there are still thousands of people vehemently defending Israel's right to self-defense. See, according to Israel and its defenders, the skyrocketing Gaza death toll should be blamed on the Palestinians for putting themselves in the line of fire. And the crux of this propaganda all stems back to one single extremely loaded talking point.
What Hamas wants to do is have a lot of civilian casualties, and they use this strategy of human shields for a reason, because they think it works.
We're using missile defense to protect our civilians, and they're using their civilians to protect their missiles.
A growing number of media outlets are starting to look at how Hamas does use civilians as human shields.
I can't believe that you're telling me people don't want to die. There is a culture of martyrdom that we hear about all the time. One of the big differences...
Yes, human shields. From speeches to infographics like this one, the human shield claim has been used as the crux of Israeli propaganda to absolve the government of any accountability. There's only one problem. Besides rockets found in an abandoned school, there's been zero evidence to back up the claim that's regurgitated without question across the media establishment. In an article titled "The Myth of Hamas Human Shields" by The Independent, it reads, some Gazans have admitted they were afraid of criticizing Hamas, but none have said they've been forced by the organization to stay in places of danger and become unwilling human shields. See, for many Palestinians, there's simply nowhere to go. The strip of land they live on is about 25 miles long and is one of the most densely populated places on Earth. Its borders are closed, and many people have made the decision to stay inside their own homes instead of trying to evade death on the streets. In fact, the journalists who have been on the ground in Gaza have reported that they've seen zero evidence as well to back up the human shield claim. Amazingly, despite the loaded term being parroted to absolve Israel of its blatant war crimes, one entity that I could find systematically using human shields is Israel. And here are just three examples documented in the past couple of years. Look, this cruel and inhumane tactic is internationally banned and a violation of the Geneva Conventions, which is exactly why it's consistently used to demonize the enemy. The establishment wants you to look at these people and say, hey, they want to die. They encourage death. They have such little value for life that they actually shield themselves with other civilians. It's the oldest trick in the book to make people sponsoring the massacre feel better about themselves, which is exactly why we're seeing this unfold in Gaza. The indiscriminate bloodshed isn't seen as horrendous or deliberate by the majority of the people. Instead, it's seen as, oh, well, what are we supposed to do when coalition forces are trying to gather enemies and they're firing behind civilians? I've talked about how propaganda works to make one man's freedom fighter another man's terrorist. And this framework is being used to build cases against the states the government wants to topple. And no talking point is more magical to get this done than that of the enemy's use of human shields. One has to look no further than the infamous Bin Laden compound raid by SEAL Team 6, where U.S. officials claimed he was using his wives as human shields when he was shot. When all was lied and done, officials were forced to admit that there was no use of human shields. In fact, according to the official narrative, the world's most wanted man wasn't even armed when he was allegedly executed. And it's not just Bin Laden. In fact, nearly every major world conflict of war involving the U.S. in the last 50 years has included this argument. In Libya, despite Gaddafi being boys with U.S. politicians just the year prior to the NATO bombing campaign, the human shield talking point was used ad nauseum. Hilariously, the only uncorroborated citation of this happening was through the NATO-supported rebel fighters on the ground that ultimately ousted Gaddafi, killing and sodomizing him with a metal pole. In fact, leading up to the Iraq War, Bush included the human shield talking point as a main tenet of his campaign to oust Saddam. Now, there is evidence of Saddam holding people hostage near military targets during the invasion of Kuwait. However, little evidence exists of a systematic use of human shields during his reign. The lack of evidence didn't stop Bush from fear-mongering the world about Saddam's long history of devaluing human life through the use of human shields. Media Roots journalist Robbie Martin even found an entire CIA report dedicated to Saddam's use of human shields during the height of the U.S. propaganda machine, selling the Iraq War. Bush even tried to preemptively justify the mass civilian death toll he knew was certain to come with the invasion by saying that the Iraqi dictator plans to, quote, shield his military and blame coalition forces for civilian casualties that he has caused. Sound familiar? Moving on to Afghanistan, where Taliban militants were accused of, quote, using civilians as human shields, according to government officials. Just another narrative spun by the military with no actual evidence backing it up. But this term has long been applied even before the war on terror. During the Vietnam War, the Viet Cong was accused of using defenseless civilians as human shields. And during World War II, the Japanese Army was accused of doing the same. In both instances, the enemy was painted as having zero regard for human life. Right. Because the U.S. military and its partners in crime have so much respect for life, blowing up countries, desecrating culture, slaughtering millions of people, torturing, and holding them indefinitely. Look, every society, culture, and country has extreme aspects to it, and Muslims are no different. But taking the most extreme scenario that exists among the culture and exploiting it to generalize an entire demographic is extremely disingenuous, and frankly, it's racist. And when we use these terms, it paints Muslims or Arabs or Palestinians as different, ignoring that we're all human beings, bleeding the same blood, feeling the same pain, and suffering the loss of our loved ones just the same.
Ein schönes Land mit seinen Wäldern, Bergen, Seen, mit seinen Menschen, die ihm nützlich sind. Mein Land ist schön. Mein Land ist ein gutes Land mit seinen Fragen, seinem Mut, mit Freundlichkeit für seine Kinder. Mein Land ist gut. Mein Land ist mein Vaterland. Dass ich hier lieb, macht's nicht allein. Es ist, weil ich hier ganz zu Hause bin. Mein Land ist mein.
Okay, listen to Back in the USSR. You're on 93.3 FM CFRU. So that was a couple of clips from Breaking the Set from last year. Just talking about the situation in Palestine and just basically how the Palestinian people are oppressed and the way they're treated by the State of Israel. And I concluded that with the an instrumental version of the anthem of National Anthem of Palestine. And I also included that with a song from a country which actually did provide a lot of support for the Palestinian cause, like during the time that it existed, and that, of course, is actually East Germany. And so they actually had a song called Mein Land, you know, My Land. And that was that one. So, of course, this is what the Palestinian people, of course, are fighting for. They're fighting for their land, fighting for liberation. And, of course, you know, they're living in one of the most brutal occupations on the planet right now. So this is what they're up against, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to express my solidarity with them on the 67th anniversary of Nakba Day, and why I wanted to do that here tonight. So the way I want to take this forward is I want to play a talk which was recently given by... The reason why I want to play this for the most part is because I'm planning on having an interview with him next week, so hopefully he'll actually be on the show next week. And this, of course, is Dr. Michael Parenti. He, of course, has written many, many books. I've had him on the show before. I even brought him to Guelph in 2011, where he gave a speech. This is him talking on talking media, basically about U.S. imperialism in recent years, and most importantly, on the drone campaign that the U.S. is waging in Pakistan, Yemen, and basically all around the Middle East right now, and what it's the impact that it's having. So I'm going to play that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Joining me is Michael Parenti, noted political scholar, also author of his latest book, The Face of Imperialism. Michael, it's really a pleasure to have you on the show today. I think a good place to start would be to talk about how media coverage and how it shapes political discourse has shifted over recent decades, maybe from where it was in the 50s, 60s, going to where we are today. How would you characterize the change and the effect of media on politics?
I think we should keep in mind that the major mainstream media are not independent players in the political game. They are not only close to corporate America, not only friendly to corporate America, they are a component of corporate America. I mean, they're giant corporations. They, on their boards of directors, there sit the CEOs of various different corporations of oil industry, auto industry, transportation, Monsanto, all these people. They actually sit on the boards of the big companies. A company like Fox is the personal instrument of a self-described radical conservative by the name of Rupert Murdoch, and they follow a very far-right view. So they reflect the people who own them. They serve the people who own them. In addition, they are influenced by the government that they're supposed to be critically reporting about. But the national security state, the U.S., the CIA, the FBI, they too have exercised influences as to what they'll put out to the media, how the media will cooperate with them when they ask them to kill a story, how reporters are aware that they can get frozen out if they say or they ask questions that are too disturbing at press conferences, for instance. They'll just be passed over. They'll get a reputation of asking troublesome or really critical questions. Well, then they don't get any responses. They don't get any stories. So the media we always think of how the media manipulates us, but the media themselves are manipulated by the powers that be. The big advertisers, anybody, I think it was Calvin Trillin who made the point that and any, even the local media, state, municipal level, anybody who has any kind of serious economic power is someone you don't write critical stories about in your newspaper or on your radio station and such.
Well, I think it's interesting because when it comes to the American two-party political system, one of the best ways to avoid having a story covered by mainstream media is to have Democrats and Republicans essentially agree on it, right? And I think we see this so drastically with the issue of drones. Drones are something that George W. Bush exploded a lot of the drone policy. President Obama has essentially continued or grown it even further. And Mitt Romney would have done nothing different. And we basically have a mainstream media that almost does not discuss, at least in any critical way, the use of drone warfare and its legality.
That's correct. If anything, they apologize for the crimes of the drones. They say that war is war, and occasionally, you know, it's unavoidable that occasionally an innocent person will get killed here or there. Well, in fact, they should more accurately report that over 90% of the drone victims are innocent civilians and small villages who couldn't even find the United States on a map, let alone be a mortal terrorist threat to us. So, in that sense, that's right. They are apologists for that sort of thing. You know, the whole thing. The media often says that we cannot avoid. We don't intend to kill these people. Those are unintentional deaths, and that happens in wars. But, you know, there is in civil society, there's not just intention or unintentional. You can't just shoot into a crowd to kill one person and kill six others and say, oh, but I didn't intend to kill those other six. That was unintentional. There is another concept in criminal law, and that's liability, and even civil law. Liability is if you do things that are inevitably going to hurt other people, innocent people, you're liable for that. You know what you're doing. You know, so if you drop a bomb saying, I want to kill A, oh, but I have no intention of killing B, C, and D, then that's a poor defense. And yet I hear that kind of thing in the media. They're apologists for things like drones, and you're right, both Republicans and Democrats take it, and the media dare not make a critical utterance of the kind I just made.
So the problem we basically have is, if you have the two political parties agreeing on an issue, you're going to greatly diminish the amount of coverage it will get because it is not controversial or fiery in the eyes of corporate media. At the same time, if it falls into the other category, which is Democrats and Republicans disagree, the only lens through which it will be covered is through that of here is what Democrats think and here is what Republicans think, which is also not a particularly enlightening lens for interpreting the world, is it?
No, you're right, because the Republicans have a far right-wing position, and their view, even when many of their issues are accepted and gratified and followed by the White House and all that, they just keep pushing further and further right. And the further and more extreme right they go, the more they shift over the center of political gravity. So they take the far right, and the Democrats now, under someone like Obama, really have a right-center view. So what you have is the whole left wing, a whole other perspective or variety of perspectives on the left, which are just amputated and taken off, and you don't hear them in the media. And that is called objective coverage. The media thinks it's objective when they present the issues that are being mouthed by the political and economic leaders of the country. That's seen as objective.
And what you're really getting to, one of the issues you're alluding to here, I think, is that of just this real, frank, and honest discussions of the basics of the economic system that we have. And we saw, interestingly, with the entire Occupy movement, we saw that for the first time, really in a long time, as economist Richard Wolff has said on this program, a discussion of capitalism more broadly was all of a sudden existing. It was very, very limited, but phrases like income inequality were for the first time in a long time mentioned by politicians on both sides of the aisle as something real. So to that extent, were we right to be surprised that there was this injection of a new idea by Occupy? In other words, is it that missing from the political discussion?
Yes, I thought it was rather remarkable to hear hear statements made critically about capitalism. But even there, the coverage was heavily slanted. The police were treated very favorably. The police got away with some terrible acts of violence and such, and these were not usually reported. You know, we may have seen them on the internet, but they were not reported in the mainstream media. There was a systematic suppression of the Occupy movement. That movement came out of nowhere. I mean, you've got to hand it to the American people. They're pounded with a certain propaganda, a certain establishment viewpoint, yet they were able to come around that viewpoint and respond with some reality and say, look, that isn't what's happening. What we have today is 1% controlling the wealth and the well-being. And the growth in income has been monopolized by them over the last 20 years. Income inequality is worse than it ever was before. People are working harder and harder just to stay in the same place. If you're working harder and harder to stay in the same place, you're not staying in the same place. You're falling behind. And that sort of thing. And there was systemic critiques. There were critiques about people were actually uttering the word capitalism as a whole system and questioning that system. Who does it really work for? At whose expense and the like? And what we need is some alternative public ownership of things, social programs, human services, greater protection of the environment. All of these things, all of these things were coming out, and people were just talking about that, not because the liberal media had brainwashed them, quite the opposite. There's no liberal media. This is an establishment, mainstream, corporate media. That's Fox invention, talking about the liberal media, meaning they're not always as reactionary as Fox is, but they're not really critical of things.
Certainly. The last thing I want to touch on is you've been critical of some self-described progressives who focus on race, gender, and culture as aspects that are informing both media coverage and politics in the U.S., and who have downplayed the importance of class and class power. You're being very clear about that here in this interview, but talk a little bit about how that is a criticism you've made of progressives, but also how they're not mutually exclusive. In other words, class and class power relate to gender and race as well.
Well, yes, for about the last 40 years, I would say, they've been talking about race and gender, but talking about them in a way that denies the reality of class as another component. And when they do talk about class, they talk about it as a sociological category, you know, lifestyle, income level, education level, things like that. I say we should be talking about class as a social relationship. And that's what the Occupy movement did. They were saying there's 1% and there's 99%. They were actually talking about the great divide, the great class divide. That is, we're talking about how these groups relate to power and the means of power, the resources of power. The resources of power and the ownership and the wealth of the society are owned by one group, and the rest of us must find our way and try to work and earn a living and feed ourselves from hand to mouth. That struggle, that's a class power struggle, and that should be also looked at. And many people on the left did not look at that. They would also understand then that many of the race, and I'm not suggesting people ignore race, nor am I suggesting that race and gender oppression are not serious. They're life and death things. I mean, women are dying every day in the world. Because I wrote a book called The Culture Struggle, and I talked about the global rape culture. I mean, throughout the world, I wrote about this several years ago, but it describes, I have descriptions of the stuff you hear happening in India today or Pakistan, the way women are treated and even physically destroyed because these maniacs and these fools are operating. So I don't want to say, and with race too, you know, we may not have Jim Crow lynch mob rule anymore, but we still have an enormous number of black youth getting killed by police for very dubious reasons or by others. So those are very real issues. I'm not saying to brush that aside. But also, there's a dimension of racism and a dimension of sexism that is linked to the class power relationship, too. That is, by repressing people, having really depressed and repressed people who work for at a super exploitation level, you maximize profits tremendously with women and with blacks. You can see what makes them employable is their willingness to work for super exploitative wages. So sexism also feeds into the whole question of class and class power, and we really should really be looking at those issues, because that issue of class also determines the issues of empire. It also predetermines where our taxes and our money goes. It also explains why we have troops in about 60 different countries, why we have invaded and intruded upon other countries. It's to make the world safe for corporate America. And that whole, those issues are just ignored. And the phony issues that are presented to us is, oh, we go into these countries because we are humanitarian and we are concerned that the people in this country are not doing too well. When George Herbert Walker Bush invaded Somalia, he said, I'm going there because there's a famine and I want to help them. When did he ever show any concern for famine in Africa? There were about 9 countries that were suffering famine. But Somalia, they just discovered 3/4 of the country was rich with oil. And also that they had to make a presence in Central Asia and such. So, but that they can't tell that to the American people. They can't say, come on, we want to go bomb villages. We want to go kill these people because we want to take it over and increase the wealth for corporate America. Look at the French doing the same thing, Dave, right now in Niger and in Mali. Niger is one of the richest countries in the world. It has some of the greatest uranium storages. All that uranium has been going for a pittance, very cheaply going to France. Niger is one of the very poorest countries. It's one of the richest and the poorest. Those countries that are rich in resources but weak, they get taken over and colonized and plundered. And Niger has been plundered by France. 75% of French electricity is nuclear, unfortunately for all of us, because that's not safe. None of us are safe with that going on.
All right.
But that's an example of what I'm saying, how all of these kinds of things that are happening around the world, all this empire intruding, all of that is part of a class power that's being pursued and for class interest, for that 1%. And that's never mentioned by the media. Who profits from all of these interventions?
Absolutely. We've been speaking with Michael Parenti, noted political scholar. The latest book is The Face of Imperialism. Michael, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. I'm sorry if I went on and on there for a minute.
No, it's you. I couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you.
Dame, 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 dame todo el power. FM in Guelph.
Kultrun World Music Festival is happening this summer in Kitchener from July 9th to July 12th, with free performances and events throughout the weekend. The festival is the Tri-City's only family-friendly celebration of diversity and will be the only satellite celebration of the Pan Am and Parapan Games, featuring Anna Tiju, Chico Trujillo, Los Banban, Lucho Quequesana, and much more. There will also be all-ages interactive activities, workshops, storytelling, theater, and food and craft market. Come say hi to the CFRU crew, who will be broadcasting live on location during the festival. This year's festival will be held on the green grounds of Victoria Park, a physically accessible location. For more information, visit nerudaarts.ca. Remember, that's this summer in KW from July 9th to July 12th. Ahí nos vemos.
Yeah, well, I don't know, this is Tasha T, and you don't know, anytime I'm in Guelph, I always tune into Nikki Dread and the Crooked Beat. Oh, you mean, man? On CFRU 93.3 FM every Thursday from 7 to 9 p.m. You don't know, we're gonna rectify the problem. Let's live and learn to solve them. We're gonna make it work together for the children. I am in one, 25 years of reggae revolution. Set it!
Imagine something different.
The politics of austerity are driving environmental destruction and deepening inequality on a planetary scale, and mass movements have formed all over the globe to resist it. From Quebec to Greece to Chile to South Africa, millions are rising up against austerity. Let's join them.
On Saturday, June 13th, activists, organizers, and community members from throughout southwestern Ontario will meet for the regional summit to unite against austerity at 95 Crimea Street in Guelph, just across from the food bank. The event runs from 3 to 9 p.m. and will feature workshops, educationals, trainings, and a panel discussion.
Attendance is free, food and childcare will be provided, and the event is wheelchair accessible. For more information on the summit and the effects of austerity generally, go to uniteagainstausterity.ca or contact ontarioagainstausterity@gmail.com.
This indigenous isle, from pillaging fat cats, sitting on money piles, doing dirty deeds of the first.
ITT, I'm coming, Kaiser,
standing on the shoulders of people who sat and stood and fought and sacrificed their lives and time so that we'd be better off. I'm talking about ordinary people whose courage held them through. We need many Harriet Tubmans and we need many Sojourner Truths, ordinary heroes. Fields of California and the mines in Trinidad grew a spirit of justice that spread across the nation and lit a fire that burned so bright that it still brings people hope. We need many Cesar Chavez's and we need many Mother Jones's, ordinary heroes, ordinary heroes, ordinary heroes. Changes don't come about from some mystical twist of luck. They're the fruits of people sweating and stressing and never giving up. It takes a lot of hard work and commitment to lift every voice and sing. We need many Ella Bakers and we need many Martin Luther Kings, ordinary heroes, ordinary heroes, ordinary heroes. Standing on the shoulders of people who put a lot of hard work in and passed along their trials and errors to future generations. And the stories that we pass along will be the thing that keeps us in. We need many Woody Guthries and we need many Howard Zinns, ordinary heroes, ordinary heroes, ordinary heroes.
Classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit. I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back my facts. Packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion, burn mics up to ashes. I make fascists clap their pants, stanzas, cure cultural cancer. I got tunes that move you to dance, burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum. Getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis. My word act like nominally gat, rhymingly packed. Punch, crash the fun by metric tons and plus my math. Distribute cash among the classes. Take from the thieving greedy bastard. Get back like church has to get past. Collapse structure, fuck facades. I destruct the support beams and bars. Wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction. Flip the shit just like a brick throw. Dethrone kings, bring the trees on. My tone rock like Gibraltar pop. Hip hop hotter than a rocket shot. I'm crime, think, fraud, bring the big talk. Teach you to flee from the flock, walk off. Sweat shit, hit my target. Drop like bombs in the form of carpets. I got the target locked on now, aw shit. Pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a rap. Original rap at taking shit back. Boom bap, boom bap. I'm talking true path, master the craft. The pupil, the prof, keep dropping math. Boom bap, blast the bazooka rap.
rap. Boom rap, original rap. Boom rap, original rap. Boom rap, original rap. Boom rap, original rap.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, 250 watts of community power.
For your own pleasure, a well-hidden treasure, Pizza Chocadero. We serve delicious gourmet pizza with daily made dough, homemade sauce, and fresh toppings cut by hand. Ask us for our 2-1 special. Pizza Chocadero, open weekdays till 9, weekends until 10. Located at 7 Municipal, north of College in Edinburgh. Proud to be an independent family-owned business. Call 519-829-2444 or visit trocadero.ca.
Hi, my name is Peter, and I volunteer at CFRU because it's a space that really encourages creativity and expressing yourself.
My name is Stacy. I love discovering music that sounds good to me. All kinds of music.
I love the people, I love the atmosphere, and everyone loves radio, and you can tell.
If you love radio and would like to get involved, volunteer at CFRU. No previous experience is required, and we provide all the training. Check out our website at cfru.ca or call Christopher at 519-824-4120, extension 58341, or email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Volunteering at CFRU breeds minds, breeds culture. So come on down.
Get ready for